Hey, Colin.
Hey, Joel. What are we doing on the show today?
Today, we're joined by Stephen Margheim. Stephen has been doing a lot of work in improving SQLite integration with Rails. And we're talking a bunch about SQLite, vertical scaling, and kind of getting into the weeds with that.
Awesome. Well, let's get to it. So are you mostly working in Ruby, or what are you working with?
Yes. I am presently an engineering manager in my day job. So I don't get to do day-to-day Ruby web development as often as I enjoy, but it's also, it creates a unique opportunity for me to have time and availability to do open source work. But the company and the department that I work for is a Ruby on Rails shop, and I've been working with Ruby and with Rails for coming up on 10 years. And I take every opportunity I can get to sort of like carve out a internal tool project and use that as opportunities to see what new features are available and to also sort of like get away from the massive amounts of complexity that live in our 12-year-old monolith that's running on Google Cloud Platform with Kubernetes and Helm charts and Terraform. And that is what got me into SQLite originally, is like trying to find ways where I could have the joy of building web applications with Ruby, but recognizing like that the constraints that I'm in, like I need something that I can build and spin up really quickly. But even more importantly, I need to be able to debug it in like 30-minute windows between meetings. And so really focusing on aggressively cutting down operational complexity made that a possibility in a way that it just wasn't before. And now I've got maybe three different internal applications that are running in production, and we're using them, and some of them are, you know, like actual money-making projects for the company. But I'm still like the only real developer that maintains them. And a lot of that just comes from this sort of maniacal focus on stripping out all possible operational complexity from the stack.
Yeah, SQLite's amazing. It's I've been using it for many years because I do iOS development also. And so that's what you tend to use for your local data store. So using it in production like that then is the big difference. Like my understanding is that the reason people don't tend to do that is it's like concurrent writes are difficult. Am I thinking of that right?
Yeah. I think that the two biggest stumbling blocks, or maybe even myths, are that you can't do concurrent writes and you can't have a production application with production usage without being able to do concurrent writes. And that you're not going to have disaster recovery, right? So it's like you put your database on the same machine as your app server, and that one machine goes down and you've lost all of your data. That is one of the things that really got me excited about SQLite in the last couple of months, is particularly the Lightstream project from Ben Johnson, who works at fly.io now. And it just solves the disaster recovery problem, like in a really simple way. It patches into SQLite flushing content to disk and just streams it up to any S3 compatible bucket storage service, which gives you point in time recoveries. Like anytime you flush the disk, you're going to get that streamed to the cloud, and you can restore a database on any machine with that. And the concurrent writing problem, quote unquote problem, is mitigated a lot when you use SQLite in the write ahead log journal mode. It gives you concurrent reads. It still doesn't give you concurrent writes, but it opens up concurrency in a way that really dramatically increases performance, and especially for web applications, right, where you're probably going to be around 80% reads and 20% writes. And I think the thing that is often under-considered is just how much you gain from not having any network latency at all. And so even if you are serializing every single write, when that's 20% of your operations, and you are going from milliseconds to microseconds, it becomes a non-issue. And I think a lot of developers get stuck on the point that, like, it just can't work, but like it scales orders of magnitude more than I think most people presume.
Mm-hmm. It's not just the fact that you can do these, like, you can't do concurrent writes, but you can, but the writes that you are doing are so much quicker because there's no network latency, right? So if you're actually thinking about how many writes can I do per second, that's actually probably quite a bit higher than most people would think that it is. And the other thing that you can do with SQLite that that I think is really interesting is you don't have to use one database for everyone. Like, spinning up another database is quite easy. It's just a file. So you can literally make thousands of these if you want. Like, you could make it so that every, like, user or meaningful tenant of your application has their own database for writes, and that might enable you to scale, like, significantly further than you otherwise would. If you have the kind of application where within a particular tenant of that application, you know, there aren't any kind of, like, cross-tenant communications. So if you think about an app like Basecamp or an app like an email app, right, where you're always accessing your own data or your own company's data, you can actually scale that way, I think, quite easily.
Yeah, and it's got to be amazing for, like, just testing and, like, rapid development, right? Because you can just open the file, or you can just upload the file, right?
Yeah, and at the intersection of those two points is, like, the first developer experience, like, bonus feature that I came across that sort of opened my eyes to, oh, okay, not only can it give me the things that Postgres or MySQL can give me, it gives me new things that these other database engines can never give me. And I was experimenting with the thought of how difficult would it be to get planet scale like database branching locally, but without having this separation of my Git branch from my cloud service provider database schema branch. And it was surprising, but amazing to find that I added a little bit of ERB to Rails' database YAML configuration file and add one initializer hook in my development environment config file. And Rails just automatically creates and runs all my migrations and gets my database fully spun up if it doesn't exist as soon as I am in a Git branch and run any sort of app loading command, run the server, jump into a console, whatever. And it's those kinds of things that are made available because it's just a file and it is so light and so cheap that I think there's so many opportunities to do really powerful and unique things. Like, I know this last week, maybe 2 weeks ago now, this JavaScript ecosystem company, TursoDB, did a whole launch week. And they're the people behind the LibSQL project, which is like the open source clone of SQLite. And one of the major features there is to make it possible to run SQLite databases as a server database. But they specifically launched a feature to make it easy for some JavaScript framework. I don't know. I can't keep track of all their names anymore, but integrated with some handful of them to give you per tenant database files and to have local replicas in addition to your server database files and all these different things. And that kind of creativity is kind of mind-boggling. Like I still haven't even, I think, began to wrap my head around all the different possibilities. Like when you really internalize what is possible when you have an actual serverless database engine and you have something that is so lightweight to have all these different databases.
I was just going to ask on your, so you wrote, I think this was the first of a series of, was it 9 articles you wrote up about SQLite very recently? And you were talking about how you used a bit of ERB in your Rails database YAML file that is able to like switch between different databases based on your Git branch name, which is really cool. I was thinking on that, like given that SQLite is just a file, have you thought about extending seeding so that you could just use like a seed file that was checked into source control? I wonder if that would work or if that would be a problem with Git at all. But like one of the things that I keep running into at work is if I ever like mess up the database in one branch and I have to reseed, it takes absolutely ages to seed the database. Like it takes, I mean, I'm sure that there are optimizations that we could do. We could improve this problem. But like if it's just a file that you're copying and pasting, right? Essentially you're duplicating the master seed file and naming it the same as your branch. And then that's where you start when you create a new branch. I feel like that's potential as well. And then you can just check that in. I don't know if that would actually work, but I might give that a try. It's just like, yeah, just like having databases as files is just such a cool, like, superpower that SQLite gives you. I think there are loads of ways that we haven't really even thought about using it. That kind of like being able to run SQLite in production kind of opens up for you because it, although you can do this, it doesn't, I don't think it makes sense to have like SQLite be your development / test environment and then MySQL or Postgres in production. I think that's not a great way to develop an application.
I did do that once though.
Yeah.
I could not get freaking MySQL with Rails to run in GitHub Actions.
Yeah.
Because everybody uses Postgres or whatever. So it's like, could not find good documentation on how to actually do this. And I'm like, fine, I'm just going to run the tests in GitHub Actions on SQLite. And it worked fine.
But you have to really embrace the ORM if you're going to do that.
Like, yeah. Well, I mean, we did in that case, but
yeah.
I didn't, it was not like my first choice. It was more like, I really just want this to work in some way.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it forces you to really embrace the ORM, but it also really quickly exposes you to the rough edges of whatever ORM you are using. Like I found myself doing a lot of work recently just around bringing existing active record features that were implemented for MySQL and or Postgres that are built on top of very old standard SQL features that SQLite has supported for years. In one case, like literally 12 years, it's had this feature. And just connecting them, right? So it's like active record handles this, and SQLite handles this, but the Active Record SQLite adapter does not wire them together. And whenever you're working with two different databases, you're restricted to the subset of features that your ORM supports for both databases, which is often, I think, surprisingly, a smaller subset than you would imagine, you know, because it's just the nature of open source. You know, the features that are there are the features that people take time to implement.
Right. Is that stuff like generated columns, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that was one of the big ones. And there was like a handful, four or five features that the Active Record, especially the 7.1 release of Rails, brought a number of cool features into Active Record that they implemented for Postgres and MySQL and just didn't for SQLite. But yeah, generated columns, deferred foreign keys, auto-populating columns of your Active Record objects based on default functions that you define at the database level, custom primary keys, all of these things were already built. I honestly did like a week of work, which was mostly copying and pasting and editing Active Record implementations from other adapters just to make them available for SQLite.
Yeah, Active Record's interesting to me. I don't know if this is extremely related to what you were just saying, but in that it's in the realm of ORMs where it's like not abstracting the database at all versus like really abstracting it. It's kind of in the middle to me. Like it's pretty easy in a Rails app to write things that are like specific for the database you chose. Like for example, on the thing I'm working on, we're using some like Postgres specific full text stuff where we had to write like very Postgres specific code in our migrations. I don't really know how that relates to what you're saying, which is something I was thinking about.
Well, I think we were talking about like not using an ORM. Like I mentioned that you should use the same database in development as you do in production, and that you could, otherwise you would have to really lean into the ORM.
Yeah. Like what I just said, if I did the thing before where I had it for test, like it wouldn't work at all. Couldn't do that.
Yeah. I think like there are people who say that your ORM should be like that abstraction layer that you connect to and should completely hide the implementation details of the database, and that you should be able to switch between databases at a moment's notice. I think that's nonsense. You do not need to build your application like that. Like I understand the benefits, but the cost is just huge. And the cost of like missed opportunities in terms of like these features of your database that are amazing that you were not able to use. I think it makes sense if you're building an ORM to make that ORM provide just a great experience for Postgres users and a great experience for MySQL users and a great experience for SQLite users, and not try too hard to make that those experiences like consistent and homogenous. Like, like you can obviously try to make them, you know, so that if you're working on one app and then you're working on another app, it doesn't feel like a completely different thing. You know, a lot of stuff that's the same is the same and feels the same, but you shouldn't, I don't think, really try to over abstract that adapter layer, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's like, it's a nice idea when you hear it, that it's like, don't even think about this as a database. It's just an object model. And I've told you, Joel, before, like on iOS, like this is what Core Data does. Like you do not have access to be like, just give me the tables like you do in Rails, where you can just talk to it like a database. You can only talk to it through this object model layer. And yeah, it sounds good, but it definitely is not as great in practice, I've found. I like being able to, I don't know, I like not having so much between me.
Yeah, and I think the philosophy of sharp knives here is what really drives me towards wanting to embrace the database and really understand the database engine that I'm using. Because if you restrict yourself to only the representation of the tools that you're using that are provided to you through some abstraction layer, it is easy to have all of these unknown areas that are just easy wins that you don't take because you have no idea that they exist. Like you need to understand how databases are working at some decent level to really optimize, like, which indices should I use to give me the best performance? And there are really meaningful differences between how these different database engines actually store the data on disk that will have meaningful impact on your performance. And there are going to be places in your application where those differences would be really meaningful. And the simplest and easiest way for you to solve that problem would be to, you know, get through the abstraction layer and understand, all right, this is what SQLite is doing. This is how it organizes its data. So if I use this particular index, it'll be used in this particular way for this particular query, which is the essential query for this very highly performance sensitive, customer sensitive part of my application. And when you limit yourself to only the opaque and abstracted view of what's going on, so much of that is not, I mean, it just can't be available. An ORM is never going to be able to provide an abstraction that perfectly deals with the way in which different database engines organize data on disk and how that is related to the indices that you're writing.
Yeah, and that is one of the things that, I don't know if this is trendy or whatever to say this, but it's one of the things I like about Active Record is that you can just be like, all right, just like, let me talk to this like a database now. Like you can sort of get it from both ends. Like it has that abstraction, but if you just need to like give it SQL, it will also do that, which I like quite a bit. I was thinking I was going to ask you about like, and maybe you can still talk about it, but like limitations or whatever, like where would the limitations come in? I was thinking of things like full text search, and I was thinking of like PostGIS, and then I Googled SQLite full text search, and there's an extension for it, and I Googled SQLite GIS, and there's an extension for it. So maybe there, I don't know, maybe there aren't, maybe there's a lot more out there for this than I thought there was, and that those aren't where the limitations are going to come into play.
Yeah, it is, I think, a noticeably different mental model than what I sense to be the default mental model for Postgres lovers. I think Postgres sort of wants to provide a really rich and deep set of features out of the box. And SQLite takes a very different approach. But I think it's a very reasonable approach where they make it incredibly easy for developers to build extensions. And those extensions have access to everything. I mean, you can, there's almost nothing that is not exposed to extension developers. And there is a really rich ecosystem of extensions. And because SQLite itself is very easy to compile, it is a part of the extension ecosystem that they are all nearly very easy to compile across all the different environments. And they cover a really wide range, whether it's, ooh, I really want to use ULIDs, or I really want to use V6 UUIDs, or I really want vector search or geospatial search or full text search. Or, I mean, almost anything you can think of, there are extensions for them, and getting them into your Rails app is less complicated than I originally thought. Like when I went and did the research and looked up, it's like, oh, okay, this is pretty straightforward, and you can wrap it up pretty quickly and nicely. I think that the major, major limitation is that if and when, but I think it's more so if, your application gets to a place where you truly need to have multiple different app servers, you're going to need to do some real thinking and do some work. It's less crazy now because Ben Johnson of Lightstream fame sort of took that idea to the next level with a project called LightFS, that similarly hooks into the moment when SQLite flushes data to disk. And instead of just streaming it to an S3 compatible storage bucket, it streams it to a mesh of specified other SQLite files. So you can distribute the same logical database across a collection of SQLite files on various machines. So it's at least a lot less crazy now, but you now have to open yourself up to really thinking about replication and lag and where you want to direct writes and how you're sort of managing this. So it is possible, but it's certainly more complicated than running everything on a single machine. And that is where I think, and I know Joel and I have talked about this some as well, like one of my passions is to really try to talk a lot more and get people thinking a lot more about the reality that you don't need to jump into horizontal scaling nearly as quickly as you think you do. That these machines that are available today, even through these cloud providers, reach incredible sizes that can run multi-million dollar businesses. And when you keep everything on a single machine, the operational complexity stays incredibly low and you focus all of it around, I think, the kind of systems architecture design that's the most valuable. Like, all right, how do I make this one thing resilient and highly available and without taking on just a truly complicated set of problems with keeping a mesh of machines in sync and acting as if they are a single machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it's such a great it's such a great tool in that like goal of like trying to reduce complexity, like operational complexity when you're deploying an application. Like literally it doesn't just replace Postgres or MySQL that you would have to run on an external service, but it can also replace what you would otherwise use perhaps Redis for, right? You can do your caching with SQLite, and you can use a different SQLite database, right? So your cache writes aren't going to impact the writes, you know, we're talking about sequential writes, the writes of your main application, and you can do jobs, right, through another database, where again you might have used Redis otherwise. And it's just incredible. Like, you can actually, if you really work on it, like get your operational complexity down to an incredibly simple single machine that you can scale vertically pretty far. Like, we were looking at the largest machine you can rent, and I think the biggest one we found was 128 virtual CPUs from AWS, like with about 2 terabytes of RAM. And that's pretty insane. You can run a lot of like requests per second through that. I think it's like what you were saying to me before is that people's perception of what's possible with SQLite is like orders of magnitude out of whack with like what is real. Like, the reality is you can scale this thing to, you know, millions of dollars of business, millions of customers, and then at that point you can think about the other stuff, right? And it's not like there aren't options. There, you talked about LightFS being able to, distribute your database onto multiple machines. I don't know how that would solve the write problem if you had like a global database you weren't able to shard by tenant. But like, there are definitely options, and I think that it's so easy when you're starting a new like business or you're starting a new app, you think that it's going to scale like crazy and you're going to run into these problems, but like actually keeping it as simple as possible for as long as possible is the way to go. And I think, I'm just so excited about SQLite's potential to do that for Ruby developers. And I love all of the changes you've made to Rails recently. Like, it's super awesome that we can do that now.
Yeah. And I think to go back to your question, Colin, about like limitations, I do think that a lot of these myths and perceptions do come from a real place, because the default experience with SQLite is really in no way whatsoever optimized for web applications. The SQLite project and the SQLite core team optimize their work pretty explicitly around the principle of backwards compatibility. They are maniacal about backwards compatibility, but they have pushed the software forward in really amazing ways in the last 15 years. But basically, none of those features are enabled by default. And the default experience, if you just install SQLite and connect to it, is not going to feel great. By default, you're going to have sequential reads plus sequential writes with a performance profile that is not going to look anything like all the blog posts you've read online about getting microsecond reads. So I really think one of the most important things is, and this was one of the pull requests I was happiest to get into Rails that they were amenable to it, is to make the default experience for web applications reasonable, because it does require some work and it does require some knowledge to know, okay, of the 50 different runtime configurations and 50 different compile time configuration options, which ones should I turn on in which ways for what reasons, because I'm in a web application context and not a archival context or a low power embedded device context or high powered embedded device context, or fill in the blanks. And once you do, though, like learn the levers to pull and you pull them appropriately, then you start to see all of these possibilities open up and to recognize, okay, actually, this really can genuinely be a production grade business driving database engine for your side project or your company or what have you. It really is genuinely, that is not true if you don't configure it correctly, and it is not configured for that use case out of the box. And I think that that is a major stumbling block that people need to be aware of. And hopefully more web application frameworks do this. I think right now, like Rails is sort of at the vanguard in that way, to bring the default experience, to a place where it is correctly optimized. And the Ruby ecosystem in general, I did some work with Mike D'Alessio, who's the maintainer of the SQLite 3 Ruby gem. And similarly, we're trying to bring that default experience to a place where it is out of the box configured for 2023 web applications and not for 2012 archival projects.
Do you think that just configuration, I'm trying to think of where, okay. So when I worked at Apple, we were working on the Reminders app, and at some point while we were doing internal testing, I think I've talked about this on the show before, but one of the projects I worked on was where we started getting messages from internal testers that were like, hey, I have, you know, so many reminders and basically your app stops working, you know, kind of. And it was not like, it was in the, because every time you check one off, right, that doesn't get deleted. That's just sort of there, but you can't see it. And so you can imagine that if you were, since we were creating a new version of the same app and we were like migrating them, that if you'd already been using the app for 5 or 7 years or whatever, and you're checking off a few a day, you could kind of easily get to like 10 to 20,000 reminders over all time. And basically the app would stop working for certain people because of that. And I remember one of my coworkers being like, well, you know, maybe SQLite just can't scale to what I'm like, SQLite can definitely store 10,000 reminders. Like the issue, and like, that's not that much data. like the issue actually ended up being that we had there's a daemon on your phone or Mac called RemindD. You can look it up, and it owns the database. And so the bottleneck was actually communicating between the app and the daemon. But somebody still had that impression, and I found it very surprising. I'm trying to just think, like, I don't know, is it from that the default configuration doesn't give you the best performance characteristics, or is it more just like a word of mouth sort of thing, like received wisdom sort of thing? Maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah, a little bit of both, because there have certainly been moments in the evolution of SQLite over the last 10 to 15 years where it was not optimized for many of these use cases. They make advances and improvements, but they don't turn any of them off on by default. So if you're a developer and you had an experience where early on you're using the rollback journal and you are doing really aggressive writes, you haven't really thought through your indices, probably it would not surprise me at all that developers had real experiences in the range of 2003 through 2013, maybe, where they thought, this is never going to work for the kind of middle tier scale for a web application that I'm going to need. But when SQLite introduced the write ahead log and brought concurrent reads and kept improving the performance characteristics of how they work with data on disk. Like, this is another configuration option. Like, by default, SQLite's going to flush to disk after every single write query. And that is an expensive operation. And you can get nearly perfect durability guarantees. Nearly perfect. Not exactly perfect. It'll be more perfect if you flush to disk after every single write. But you get to like 99.349s of durability. Relaxing that constraint, SQLite will flush to disk. Maybe it's a little bit of a complicated algorithm, but it's roughly every 1,000 writes. And that right there is like, you know, not quite, but it's around like 1,000 times faster, because you're just doing the most expensive operation 1,000 times less. So there's all kinds of these advancements that SQLite has made, but they don't turn any of them on by default. So you have an experience 10 years ago, and that's a real experience, and you share it and you talk about it, but SQLite, the project, deals with that, provides fixes for that, but none of them are going to be there when you just install it and run it.
I get the feeling that because that feature isn't 100% perfect, that might well be one of the reasons why it's not enabled as well. Because like SQLite is so thoroughly tested and held to such a high standard that I expect that's just not acceptable to be the default. Like if you were using SQLite to do some kind of like bank transaction log or something, right, you would definitely not want to have any chance that any of those writes weren't written to disk, like, ever. And so you would need that feature. And I guess it's just part of the kind of philosophy of that project is that it's safe by default and you can opt into these like optimizations as you want. But like, that's your decision to make.
Yeah, I do think that is a key part of their philosophy. And it's connected to that perspective of like really prioritizing backwards compatibility. As you said, like it's probably the most tested piece of software in the world of like meaningful usage.
I think it's like pretty much the most tested piece of software out there as well. I was listening to an amazing podcast about this, which I will have to find and put in the show notes. But yeah, it's like the testing like puts my testing to absolute shame. I mean, they're testing every single branch of like the compiled machine code or something like that. I can't quite remember the details, but there's this like certain standard that they meet, and like, it's just insane.
Yeah. They do logically exhaustive testing. Right. I was watching a talk recently, that had looked at the source code and the ratio of lines of code to lines of test is 250 to one or one to 250. It is intense, but it does go to the point that they do a really interesting thing. And I commend them for it. Like that their default philosophy is grounded in backwards compatibility, safety, and future proofing. But they also are pushing the tool forward to make it usable in so many more contexts than data archival or, you know, low power embedded devices. But, you know, that comes with exposing a lot of different hooks for you to configure, like, what is your use case? How do you want the software to run? But the benefit of the insane, maybe, approach to testing is that you can also feel really confident, right? That whatever specific combination of compile time and runtime configuration options that you have set, that you're not off in a place that no one has ever considered and you're going to fall off the edge of the world. Like, they have tested that configuration of SQLite in all of the different ways in which SQLite is going to be used. So there is this opportunity.
They've also tested it on basically every machine, right? Every CPU architecture that exists, like including ridiculously outdated mobile phones, like Nokia phones and things. Like, when you say every permutation, you really mean it.
Yeah. It's the more you dig into it, the more deeply impressive it becomes.
Yeah, I wonder also if it's not just like a reliability thing, like you guys were talking about with the like the write ahead logs, that's what it's called, right? I wonder if it's also just about like the expectations, like the default expectations. I think I heard Richard Hipp, who's the Dr. Richard Hipp, the creator of SQLite. I think he said they're not competing with Postgres or MySQL. They're competing with like FOpen or FWrite, which are the C functions for just like writing a block of data out to a file. And I am thinking, like, if you wanted to use SQLite as a replacement for sort of that use case, that having things where like it's only going to write out over so long or what, it like maybe that isn't your expectation, and so that wouldn't be the default for them.
No, I think that that's exactly right. And I think that we are lucky that the maintainers are so ready and willing to expand the possible use cases of SQLite in the ways in which they build and develop the tool, that you get something that in end result, when you take in the full ecosystem of extensions, the really wide array of configuration options, the maniacal approach to testing, that can at the same time compete with these operating system IO operations in terms of performance and reliability, but also compete with Postgres in terms of usability and power. And I think that there is a real sort of trend bubbling up in the web development world to start to appreciate that SQLite really can actually be a legitimate replacement for Postgres or MySQL. And it comes with all of these opportunities for radically simplifying operational complexity, as well as opening up entirely new developer experience, app architecture possibilities. I mean, we've discussed a lot of the major ones already. And that is incredibly exciting because I think it so radically lowers the barrier to entry for somebody wanting to get their first web application like on the internet and actually running it. I think it's easy for us to lose sight of what a jump it is to go from get this piece of code that's running on your laptop to run on some other computer that's running on the internet. Oh, and also get another computer to run this piece of software, connect the ports. Oh, right, there are ports. Here's how you secure those ports. You're going to want to have a firewall. Don't expose that one to the internet. That would be crazy. Here's what it means to expose a server to the internet, so forth, so on. I mean, it spirals out of control, the amount of things you need to learn and understand. And when you strip all of that away and make it possible to have a tutorial or a web application framework that allows someone to take a real application that solves a real problem and put it on a single machine, and it's up and it's running and it can do all the stuff, caching and background jobs and full text search and persisting user data and all the cool, interesting things, without spending 6 months to understand how to have your mesh of interconnected servers running the various different kinds of services to drive all that functionality for you.
The big win in my mind here is just like developer productivity, is that I was just imagining in my head if, you know, let's say I was working on something with Joel and I'm like, hey, Joel, I'm having this problem. Let me Slack you my database or whatever. And then he can just run it and see what I was dealing with. And, you know, that would be so much more, that's not the way it would work normally. And that seems like such a big win. Or being able to seed it easily, like all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's also like, I remember when I first started like learning to code, you know, I was doing front-end development for quite a long time before I got into back-end. So I already had a lot of experience and like familiarity with technology and with like hosting websites and that kind of thing. But it's super important, that time between starting an application and being able to see it running somewhere and being able to like send someone a link and they can use it. Like, that is such a key factor to someone who's new to a software framework or a programming language or whatever, being able to get up and running and like feel like they're being productive and feel like this is the place for me. This is where I'm going to write my software. And this is what I want to do because I enjoy this. Like, there are so many blocks that make that really difficult. And I love that, like, this is just an example of how we can simplify things. The other line, like along this kind of trend, is just like, I've been getting really frustrated that computers are getting so fast and software is getting so slow, like just in general, and not just like the software that I have to use every day is crappy and buggy. And I just wish that they would just delete all their JavaScript and let me click and just wait for the page to load. I don't care. Like, just simplify it to get rid of the bugs. That would help. But like, when you actually come to developing the software, like, that gets really complicated as well. Like, I'm lucky enough to work somewhere I don't have to deal with the crazy front end stack on top of everything else. But I can't imagine having to deal with like all of the like React and front end layer, plus all of the back end, plus the database, like being in this completely separate service that you have to set up. Like, when you add it all up, it's just so much and it's so complicated, and it just doesn't need to be. Like, especially if you're writing an application that maybe a million people are going to use, right? You can run that on one machine. And you can have it running like in 15 minutes. I don't know. That's a just a bit of a just general rant, but about how crap this whole industry is getting. Like, I just can't believe that things are slow now. Like, when you look at the raw performance of hardware that we have now compared with 5 years ago, it's just insane that web apps are still slow.
So, okay, this is something, sorry.
Anyway, run over.
I mean, here's the thing, Joel, it's always been crappy.
Yeah. It's always, but every time they make the hardware faster, every time the browser vendors make the browsers faster, the software engineers make the software crappier.
I mean,
somehow.
Here's the thing, you got to fill your time with something. And if it's not making 1,000 JavaScript frameworks each crazier than the last, what are you going to do? You got to do something with your time. So let's say somebody's listening to this episode, right? And they're like, great, SQLite, this sounds awesome. I like all these ideas and benefits. But I'm afraid that I will go with this, right? And I'll have this architecture of different files for different things. And then I'll become the next Shopify. And this maybe didn't turn out to, there was a point where this wasn't going to work. Is that a fear that you should have, or do you think that's silly?
Well, it shouldn't be a fear. It should be a hope that you get to the point where you can find the 5 absolute best SQLite on a single machine to MySQL distributed across the entire globe, migration experts in the world, pay them a massive amount of money relative to them and what is a rounding error relative to your revenue, and have the problem solved in 6 months. It's also, I think, and I really want to, something I've started digging into to really start to crunch some of the numbers and do some napkin math. It's important for people to understand really how incredibly high the ceiling is for vertical scaling. I think everyone has a similar idea. They're like, okay, SQLite, oof, I've got 50,000 rows in my database and I have like 5 tables and they all have like 50,000 records. Yeah. And it's like, I say this to people regularly, right? Like, whatever your estimate is for the ceiling, you are probably at least 2 orders of magnitude off. You know, the maximum file size that SQLite can handle and process, do all the reads and writes and everything, is 280 terabytes.
It's a lot of reminders.
Right. So when we get a machine that can store a file of that size, SQLite is ready to process it. I really think that when people have that thought, what they're really thinking is that the ceiling is incredibly low for vertically scaling a web application on a single machine. And point one is that the ceiling is incredibly high, right? So we just talked about you can rent an AWS machine today with 2 terabytes of RAM.
Yeah, the ceiling's not 50,000 records, it's 50 million or something.
Yeah. And the ceiling of like requests per second is not 50 requests per second, right? It's tens of thousands, or it's thousands. And then the second key point is that, like, if you actually do reach true web scale, planet scale needs, it is actually a rounding error on revenue to hire the best in the world to go and solve that problem for you. And it's a solvable problem. You know, a lot of companies have done this.
On that point, it's actually not true that you can scale MySQL infinitely either. So you use the example of Shopify. I happen to work on the infrastructure team at Shopify. And I know that we didn't scale MySQL infinitely. We use sharding. And sharding is basically where you say, I need to, like, this application is too big. I need to break it up into parts. And so we would be able to run the whole application. And that involves like all of the Redis, all of the Memcache, all of the like the database, the application servers, the job servers, all of that stuff. Like that entire instance is replicatable in a pod. And that pod has its own database, its own set of like shops, et cetera, et cetera. And you basically shard. So you say, if you own this shop, this domain, this main shard is going to take that request and it's going to direct you to the correct pod for your application based on your domain name. That's how it was done when I was there. And then you're on a smaller database that maybe has your shop and, I don't know, 100 other shops, 1,000 other shops. Depends like how big your shop is and how big other people's shops are, right? But you can do the same thing with SQLite. In fact, it's so much easier to do with SQLite because it's just a file. You don't have to like go through the effort of like, okay, we need to have like these databases, but for efficiency's sake, they need to be quite big. Because databases, you know, are expensive and difficult to run. So we need to have, you know, we need to try to get at least 100 shops on each one, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You could just be like, okay, every shop gets its own database. It's as simple as that. And when you do that, a bunch of other problems are solved for you as well. Like, I don't know, let's say you have some N plus one query somewhere, right? That N plus one query isn't so bad when it's on a tiny database that just has, you know, 1,000 products from this one shop, as opposed to, you know, 100 billion products from all of these other shops as well. And so I just feel like even if you reach web scale, yeah, you're going to have to invest in some infrastructure. You're going to have to invest in whatever that infrastructure is to be able to load balance and like move people around and figure out how you're going to split your data. And obviously some, you know, the user accounts and the domain names, that stuff needs to be centralized somewhere. That's going to be very much read heavy. But like, I think that the options are still there, and it's just not going to be an issue. It's a solvable problem.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, what I'm thinking about right now is how when I look on my Mac, right, a lot of the files in my documents folder, they have whatever extension they have, but except for the ones that are literally just like a text file, they have whatever extension. It's actually a SQLite file, though. Like, you could drop it onto like your SQLite app and it would come up. And a lot of the ones that aren't that, you can right-click on and click show package contents, because it's actually just a folder. That's just like a special type. And inside of there, there's a SQLite file and then like some other like support files and stuff that go with it, which I guess is like not actually, like conceptually to me, not actually that much different than what you just said, right? Of like just spreading things out, like a document can be a SQLite file or whatever.
I just had another thought, which is... let's say, for example, the European Union passes some legislation that means that you need to be able to give people a copy of their data, right? How much work do you think that is for a company like Shopify? It's a huge amount of work, right? Huge teams of people are working on that for years, like to solve that problem. If you have a database for every tenant in your application, you can just let them download the database. Like, you can just let them download the file. I just feel like there's so many extra like problems that we might not even think about that are just kind of solved automatically by doing this kind of thing.
Yeah, in a similar vein, there was a blog post from Fly.io, who's one of the companies really experimenting a lot with what actually becomes possible when you lean into SQLite. And they, you know, they have a number of services that are running on their machines. They're a platform as a service provider. And, you know, you have this problem for coordinating these internal services of needing to have APIs to allow the different services to coordinate with each other. But they had the insight that if the database that we are using to store the data that we are exposing through our API to these internal services is SQLite, we can actually just like expose the SQLite databases. Like, you can open a connection to a SQLite database in an immutable mode. You can make it read-only, and just allow the other services in your internal network to query the database. Like, no JSON intermediary, no, I mean, and we've all seen the blog posts. They are legion, right? Like, the number one bottleneck on these APIs is JSON serialization and deserialization. Like, you're not going to get past that. You can make it as fast as you want. It's going to be most likely the slowest part of your API. And that's just another example of like the possibilities that open up when you embrace this kind of simplicity. And I think for me, the biggest fundamental realization has been that, you know, I genuinely believe that there are high leverage tools, right, that give you 80% of the value for 20% of the effort. And when you find them, you should really put your weight onto that lever, because you're going to be able to move a lot of value. And the more that I use it, the more that I read about it, the more that I experiment with it, the more confident I am that SQLite is one of the highest leverage tools available to developers. I mean, it is a powerful lever.
I was trying to think of a funny name for when you said you would just give somebody, you know, a connection to your SQLite. I'm like, what would you call that? Would you call that like a hillbilly GraphQL, or I don't know. I was trying to think of, no, this yeah. is all great.
GraphQL has the same serialization issue, right? Like, GraphQL not only has the serialization issue, but it also has the fact that you can't, like, it's incredibly difficult to optimize for the queries that are going to be made through that GraphQL endpoint. I think a lot more than it is to optimize for database queries. Oh, I was just going to bring up, you published a gem today, which I believe basically lets people get the new features that are coming to Rails around SQLite before their release, because they're coming out in 7.2. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, whatever the next
right.
version of Rails is, who knows what they tag it as. But yeah, it's one of the sadder aspects of starting this work is the random timing of it happening right when, after, I don't know, two and a half years of working on Rails 7.1, I finally get around to making SQLite in Rails kind of awesome again. And it's the week that they actually finish that up, and half of the work makes it in and half of the work doesn't. So yeah, I wanted to make it possible for any application on 7.1 to be able to immediately get access to the full set of features that are coming with Rails. So that's full support for all of the different active record features that SQLite supports, like deferred foreign keys and generated columns, both of which aren't in the 7.1 release, but all the code is there and it's tested, and it, you know, they will be merged. It just, I was 2 days late. But also to bring a few more enhancements that I haven't yet talked with the Rails core team and gotten a sense of whether or not they would be able to make it into Rails and might just always live in a gem. So one example, going back to our conversation before, is making it easy to load extensions through your database configuration file. To just say, here's the extensions I have installed for my app. I would like them to be loaded, and knowing how to do the Rails incantation to actually ensure that all of your connections in your connection pool are going to have those extensions loaded. And similarly, to expose the ability to add whatever additional runtime configuration you want explicitly in your database YAML file. So those are some features that, as of right now, I am not even sure if they would make them into Rails, but I think they're really valuable enhancements to the developer experience of working with SQLite in Rails specifically. And those are brought in with the gem as well. So it's a mix of these more quote unquote advanced active record features that didn't make it into the Rails 7.1 release, as well as some of these developer experience features that make it easier to do these kinds of more advanced use cases. And then also just having the gem there makes it a sandbox for us to, as a community, figure out like what are the ways in which we can make the experience of developing a web application with SQLite as our database as powerful and seamless as possible.
Yeah, that sounds great. We'll be sure to include the a link to the to your gem in the show notes. You also have contributed a fair bit to Lightstack. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, Lightstack is a wonderful project that in a lot of ways was the light bulb moment for me to recognize like how flexible embracing SQLite can be. So it's a gem by at Oldmo on GitHub or on Twitter that provides a SQLite-backed version for all of the I/O components of Rails or of really any web application. So you have data persistence, so active record in Rails's case. You have a job backend, active job in Rails's case. You have a cache backend, active support cache in Rails's case. And you have a, of course, I'm going to blank on the fourth one now that I'm in the groove and listing them. Pub sub, right. Action cable. It's your pub sub server. And then by bringing all of those under a single umbrella, you can add a few more enhancements. So in addition, the project now includes full text search capabilities. And it also keeps performance metrics across all of those different components and exposes a web UI for that. So the fundamental idea is to like demonstrate and make it possible for your Rails application to go all in on SQLite, right? So you can have four different files in your application that serve as the back end for those four different operations. And it manages everything for you. It is really optimized for performance. Muhammad is, he's one of these SQLite gurus. I actually found out in my most recent call with him that his homepage of his browser is the SQLite release page. So whenever there's a new release, he makes sure to read through the release notes. And yeah, so this is, I think, the sort of the beacon, the shining light on the hill of like where I see the future of web development going, especially for new projects. I'm not sure it makes sense to take a project that's running in production on MySQL and migrate it over to SQLite. But when you start something new, to really see and appreciate, here are the access patterns, the read patterns, the write patterns. Like, here's what it looks like to take all of the standard advanced I/O bound components of a full featured web application and back them with SQLite and bring your entire operational setup to four files on a disk.
Yep. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I wonder actually whether if you were wanting to migrate something to this, actually replacing Redis is the first thing to do. Like, Redis is incredibly expensive, especially if you do a lot of caching. And I think you'd find that SQLite could do a pretty decent job replacing your Redis cache or your Redis job, whatever that is, job queue database.
Yeah.
And actually it's probably a little more reliable than Redis, right? But especially if you're concerned about Redis reliability, like if Redis shuts down, everything's lost, right? So, I wonder if that might be, if you're interested in doing something with SQLite, that's probably where you want to start if you already have an app.
I want to hear your thoughts on that, but it just made me think. I'm like, I just remembered a time from many years ago where I used an in-memory SQLite database for date string parsing. Because I was just thinking, I'm like, I guess you can just use this one thing for everything then. Because it was that the date formatter object or whatever in iOS at the time, you know, it's very slow because it has to like make sure it matches the format and do whatever. And then I used, there's like a lower level one, and then there's an even lower level one that's like in like the C library. And I tried all of those and then somehow ran across this idea that SQLite could do this incredibly quickly. And so I created I had a function that basically just created an in-memory SQLite database and then called it asynchronously with the string. And it lowered it took the time of doing this date parsing from like 90% of what the app did, you know, time-wise to like 0.00 something of it. So it's really, really you can probably replace your kitchen stove with it, I guess.
Especially nowadays with all the smart stoves, I'm sure, that are out there.
They're probably all running SQLite, all of them.
Yeah, they are. But I agree with you that that's a great point, that it's an ideal place to start for a number of reasons. And one of the perhaps easily overlooked reasons is simply that today, in 2023, SSD speeds are a lot closer to RAM speeds than you are probably thinking based on numbers you got in your head 5 years ago or 10 years ago. But SSD costs are way cheaper than RAM costs. I was just at Rails World in Amsterdam, and there was a talk about replacing the active support cache backend from previously using Redis to, in this case, MySQL. And in that case, even with the network latency, there was only a 40% difference. So it went from like 0.8 milliseconds to 1.4 milliseconds, which, sure, 40%, but it's 0.6 milliseconds, which is a non-meaningful amount of time. But they were able to, I think they increased their cache size like 250 times, right? So they're able to retain their cache for 60 days, and it noticeably increased the performance of their application, which was heavily using caching. And if you just consider the use case of replacing a network-bound call to MySQL with a non-network-bound call to SQLite, which, as we've already discussed, is already trying to be faster than fopen on your operating system, you get the similar benefits of being able to really grow your cache, just in terms of the amount of things that you are caching and how long you keep them in cache, without having a noticeable impact on the actual speed of each individual cache read. And you combine those two things together, and you're very, very likely, I think, if your application is meaningfully using caching, to see a performance increase.
Yeah, I think that they released a new library called Solid Cache, which is their take on this whole like using the database as a cache layer.
Cool. Well, Stephen, do you want to let people know where they can find you?
Yeah, so I am at Fractaled Mind everywhere: GitHub, Twitter, Mastodon, and my blog is fractaledmind.github.io, and I've been writing basically exclusively about SQLite for the last month and a half. So if you're interested in this stuff, you might find something interesting over there.
Cool. Well, we'll definitely make sure we link all of that stuff in the show notes and people can check it out. But I just want to thank you. I think it was a great conversation. Gave me a lot to think about. So I'm definitely going to give SQLite a look when I start my next new project.